Bubble Escapes, Kingston Canadian Film Festival, KPP Concerts, Long & McQuaid, Martello Alley, and Novel Idea. Enjoy the benefits of donating. Give today via cfrc.ca.
This episode of Viewpoints is a rerun. Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. On today's show, I'll be out and journalist Mike McCullough will be in with a documentary produced in Abbotsford, British Columbia.
Everyone I've ever loved is dead from opiates.
My best friend died of an overdose.
Zachary, he was one of my closest friends.
It has been more than 8 years since public health officials in British Columbia sounded the alarm that users of illicit drugs were dying at greater rates than historically observed.
Twice a day I died, I OD'd.
What?
Yeah. I think I've OD'd over 300 and some odd times. Like, I know guys that have OD'd over 200, 300, 400 times, so like, kind of like me, but... Then I've heard of other people that have OD'd that many times, and then the last time was the last time. And that was it. They couldn't bring the person back.
Today, more than 15,000 people have died in the province since BC declared the toxic drug overdose death crisis a public health emergency in April of 2016.
We need to change the way society thinks of people that use drugs.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide. This episode of Viewpoints is a rerun. Happy holidays.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Hello and welcome to the special edition of Viewpoints. My name is Boris Desain. I'm off on vacation and Mike McCullough in Abbotsford, BC will be taking up the job for the next 2 weeks to tell us more about the opioid crisis in BC. He spoke with the former provincial health officer of BC, Dr. Perry Kendall, who, as we said in our opening, sounded the alarm that people using illicit drugs were dying at greater rates than historically observed. In this in-depth documentary, we'll also hear about people at the center of the crisis in and around the Fraser Valley. That includes people addicted to street drugs, the people who support them through harm reduction efforts and through peer support. Please note that we agreed on a case-by-case basis to identify some interview subjects in this piece by their first name only. This was granted due to the stigma of drugs and people who use them. So here's Mike McCullough in Abbotsford, BC.
British Columbia says that on the average day, more than six people in the province die of an illicit drug overdose. Fentanyl, a highly potent and highly addictive opioid, has been detected in the toxicology of between 82 and 87% of confirmed and suspected unregulated drug deaths over most of the years of the overdose death crisis. The lone outlier was in 2016 when fentanyl and its analogs were detected in the toxicology of two-thirds of overdose victims. But beyond these cold, hard facts and figures, I wanted to get a greater understanding of the human side of this tragedy. For this piece, for Viewpoints, and for the Local Journalism Initiative, I spoke with folks directly at the center of the crisis, starting with people struggling with addiction, whether actively using street drugs or at some stage of recovery.
I personally am addicted to opiates.
I also met with people who spoke of friends and loved ones that they've lost.
Everyone I've ever loved is dead from opiates.
My best friend died of an overdose.
Zachary, he was one of my closest friends.
That was a hard one.
I spoke with several people who work in harm reduction, which is essentially an umbrella of services that seeks to prevent undue additional harm to drug users and the surrounding community beyond the drug use itself. Folks who make up a patchwork of services offered around the Fraser Valley, such as frontline outreach workers, like Ernestine O'Rourke.
We need to change the way society thinks of people that use drugs.
I also spoke with Will McClellan from Mountainside Harm Reduction Society. He operates a mobile drug testing lab which lets people try to get a better understanding of what exactly is in their stash.
My job is necessary because the drug supply as it stands, is incredibly toxic and treacherous.
And I spoke with peers, people who form an additional layer in the continuum of care around the crisis, and their lived experience often overlaps with the experiences of drug users.
A peer is like we're like-minded. We have things in common. So say like you and I both really like baseball and we went to a baseball game together, we'd be like peers on that level. Hey, my name is Zeph, peer support worker in the Fraser Valley.
And peers can be found around various places in the community, from supervised consumption sites, shelters, or out and about meeting drug users where they are. Peers are often on the front lines of preventing overdoses, using naloxone, and training others to do the same. They distribute harm reduction supplies and information, such as offering help to navigate various social services, for instance. And I spoke with Dr. Perry Kendall. Dr. Kendall was the provincial health officer of BC from 1999 until 2018. And notably, he was the PHO in 2016 when he declared the public health emergency into the crisis. Here's Dr. Kendall with a look at the decade or so leading up to the emergency declaration.
From about 2000 to 2010, we had 200 roughly per annum drug overdose deaths a year in this province. And they were mostly drug deaths due to heroin, although there's a lot of polypharmacy going on. People use alcohol, people use benzodiazepines, people use speed and heroin together. Yeah, were very common. Then we noticed in about 2012, 13, 14, the numbers started going up quite markedly. And that was clearly associated with the toxicology change in the drug market. And it was due to, it was traced back to the importation of fentanyl and fentanyl analogs, which are drugs that are many tens of times stronger than the original drug heroin, which is stronger itself than morphine, which is stronger itself than opium, the poppy derivatives.
Dr. Kendall says the potency of fentanyl is not only what makes it so risky, but since it takes a smaller amount in bulk for an effective dose, the drug is more easily smuggled, resold, and profited from. A textbook case of the iron law of prohibition.
If you prohibit a substance, alcohol, for example, rather than sell beer, which is bulky and low alcohol content, people move to selling spirits, which are more concentrated, give more of a bang for the buck, and more return for the same risk. So the iron law of prohibition says if you prohibit something but people want it, then they will find a way to get it, and the black market will happen, along with a lot of other things, including lack of quality control, lack of oversight, criminalizing not only the people who sell and produce the stuff, but the people who use it as well.
Dr. Kendall looks back to policy decisions leading up to today's crisis that pushed opiate users into doing business on the black market.
If you look to the United States, during this period of time, they were suffering from clearly an overprescription of synthetic opioids such as oxycodone. And so millions of prescriptions were being written, and they were tending to go to people who were disempowered, disemployed, unemployed. If you talk about the Rust Belt of America, all the jobs going to overseas, to lower wage markets, there was an increase in the deaths of despair, an increase in prescriptions, and we had oxycodone pill mills being set up. And so you had millions of people taking oxycodone, which is a very strong painkiller, an opioid, becoming dependent upon it. And the policy decision that was made at the time is, let's get doctors to stop prescribing. The drug will be out of the way, and we'll solve the problem that way. That's pretty fundamentally stupid, because if you have people dependent upon a substance, and the substance is no longer there from one source, you can pretty much bet your boots and somebody's going to move in with another source.
Dr. Kendall says first heroin, then fentanyl filled the void. And thus, the overdose crisis was born. I spoke with a self-reported drug user in Mission about his first-hand experiences and have agreed to only partially name him due to the stigma associated with drug use. Aaron's story with drugs didn't begin on the side of the road across the street from Haven in the Hollow shelter on Logan Avenue, but instead, a fall from a ladder put Aaron in a hospital bed with a prescription to morphine to manage the pain.
And then they were like, okay, your back's better, we're cutting you off. They didn't wean me down, they didn't do anything, they just cut me right off, and that was it. And 3 days later, I was sweating and I was so sick, and I just called the guy up and said, I need something. And he said, okay, I'll come on over. And there it begins.
Rose Foster shares a similar story.
I was on morphine 5 times a day for pain management. They cut me off cold turkey, so I needed to find something to substitute it with. I'm not saying it was the right thing, but you don't wake up the next morning and say, hey, I want to be a drug addict.
Aaron says he doesn't choose to live like this. He's hooked, in spite of having survived hundreds of overdoses.
One time it was, I think it was 14 times in 7 days. Twice a day I OD'd.
What?
Yeah. I think I've OD'd over 300 and some odd times.
How did you manage to overdose that many times and yet remain breathing, like on this side of the ground?
Fast acting people. I don't know. It's just, I have luck, I guess. Like, I know guys that have OD'd over 200, 300, 400 times, so like, kind of like me, but. Then I've heard of other people that have OD'd that many times, and then the last time was the last time. And that was it. They couldn't bring the person back.
During an opioid overdose, a victim may lose consciousness and the ability to breathe on their own. Dr. Kendall says this type of repeated trauma can cause brain damage.
Well, probably the most subtle impairments are those of the executive functions of the brain, to do with critical decision making, being able to plan ahead, being able to put off a reward for a period of time, etc. But also, if you have really serious brain injury, then you lose an awful lot of functioning, intellectual capacity, physical capacity, disabilities in movement, etc., like a stroke. It's due to lack of oxygen to the brain.
A key pillar in overdose prevention rests on being able to halt the effects of opioids if someone has taken too much and stops breathing. With quick action, overdose reversal medicines like naloxone save lives. Dr. Kendall explains how.
Opioids sit on the mu receptors in the brain are what gets stimulated by opioids. That also has the side effect of depressing respiration and consciousness. Until you can bump those molecules off the receptors, they will continue, in simple terms, just to slow down or stop the breathing. So people who've overdosed, they lose consciousness, their respiratory rate goes down, their volume of air they're taking goes down, their oxygen levels go down, and if they go down far enough, because enough of their mu receptors are blocked for long enough, the oxygen supply to the brain stops. Naloxone, Narcan, and a few other drugs as well, will come in and they will displace their antagonists. They displace the opioid molecule from that receptor and allow the respiratory function in the brain to send messages to the lungs, so the lungs, the body will start breathing again. They will sometimes come around and they will be plunged into an unpleasant withdrawal. Compared with dying, that's a relatively benign side effect.
Peer supporters are often first on the scene of an overdose, calling 911 and beginning the response to attempt to save the life of a victim. Abbotsford's Roy Berry estimates he's performed somewhere around 600 overdose reversals.
If I'm out and about, I can usually do one a weekend, two a weekend. Sometimes, depending on the drugs that are out there, somebody may bring a particularly potent batch in, and there may be four in one tent. And, I've had as many as four people down at one time. In my training, where I've trained in Vancouver Career College and whatnot, I trained how to perform a reversal alone. So it's difficult, and it requires some talent, but it can be done.
Roy describes what he looks for before intervening on behalf of an overdose victim.
Say, hey, buddy, you okay? And you try to get a response. Look to see if you can see their chest rising or their stomach moving. Look to see if their lips are moving, see if they're breathing. I've done so much of it that I've learned how to monitor the breathing. So I count the seconds between breaths, and I know when there are 5-6 seconds between breaths, they're either going to go up or they're going to go down. If they go down, great, they're coming back. If they go up, then they're working their way into 7 seconds, 8 seconds between breaths, at 9 seconds between breaths, they're they're going to overdose. And just about when they get to 9 seconds, that's when they fall out of their chair. Check to see if their lips are blue. Their lips have begun to turn blue. They've stopped breathing, and they are, you know, they're dying. You do a sternum rub, take your knuckles very firmly and rub on the chest, right in the center of the chest, up and down on the rib cage, and they're going to push your hand away and go, hey, don't do that. Great. They're alive. That's what you want. Look for the response. Get a response from them.
And Roy says if a suspected overdose victim doesn't respond, he calls 911 and initiates his training to start naloxone treatment and mouth-to-mouth with the hope of keeping the person alive for long enough for help to arrive.
What I really want 911 to do is get that ambulance rolling towards me. Right? That's the number one thing. Once that ambulance is there, I don't have to do more work. This life is not on my head. Right, and the professionals are there that know what to do.
In the street drug world, peer support workers play a critical role beyond that direct response to an overdose. They share lived experiences with drug users and can relate. They help folks by offering outreach and assistance navigating social services. Not to be overly reductive, but they're basically a friend in a time of need.
Teamwork makes the dream work.
Remember Zeph?
I wouldn't consider myself sober, but I'm off all the drugs that were problematic and that kept me in addictions and stuff like that, right? Like, I still smoke cigarettes and weed, but I'm not on the pipe and I'm not drinking till I black out every day. So, like, I've got my life back for the most part from that. So that's how I can still have that relation, because my life was every bit of what you see out here 5 years ago, right? And so that's how I come in as a peer, because I care. I grew up around it. And even if you've never yourself put a pipe to your lips, if you've grown up around it, and some part of your heart is inclined to want to be a part of these groups, to be a part of the solution, you qualify as a peer.
While using drugs under supervision eliminates some of the risks associated with overdosing, another key element of harm reduction comes in the form of drug checking. Will McClellan says the information provided by Mountainside Harm Reduction's drug test strips and FTIR spectral analysis keeps drug users aware of what they're holding.
I'm taking a mystery powder that we've found in a random baggie, and I'm going to put it on the Fourier Transform Infrared Spectrometer. What that's going to do is shine infrared light through it, measure how it bounces off the chemical bonds, and create a spectrum, what you can think of as a fingerprint, essentially. And if there's more than one substance inside it, it'll look like multiple fingerprints, one on top of the other. And technicians for this project, we use our expertise to pry the fingerprints apart and figure out exactly what there is and roughly how much of it. If we can tell a drug user that, you know, that their particular batch contains 20 to 30 milligrams of fentanyl per point, then they can get a dose out of that.
Is there any way you can quantify how many lives you think you may have saved by helping people avoid dangerous stuff?
It would almost be irresponsible of me to speculate, but it's definitely more than one, so it's worth it. It's basically increasing the amount of available information for people. That's what we're about.
Zeph invites people to listen to the stories of folks who have fallen into cycles of addiction with empathy.
If you can try to find it in yourself, like getting down on their level, on your knees, and realizing that the only thing that really separates you people is luck. It's not choices, because God forbid you're ever in a car accident 10 years from now and you're in a coma for 6 months and then you can't walk for 2 years and you need pain medication the whole way to get back to normal. And then as soon as the doctor deems you fit to walk, you're kicked out and you're cut off, but now you have this addiction. Is your family supposed to shame you and kick you out because you have an addiction, or would you like help and support? Right? It's not a choice. It may have started that way, yeah. It could have been bad decisions, bad choices that led to it. But once addiction gets a hold of you, whether it's process or it's addiction, like physical substance, whatever, your brain's been rewired, right? It's a disorder. It's a disease. It's something that we need help and we need to help with.
We spend a lot of our time in life chasing dopamine, the neurotransmitter that makes us feel good, that gives us a high. Runners get a dopamine high when they stop running. Gamblers get a dopamine high when they win. Sex gives gives us a dopamine high. A good meal gives us a dopamine high. Alcohol gives us a neurotransmitter high. We are physically designed to go after that feeling of goodness. And a lot of people who fall into addictions to whatever it is are vulnerable people whose previous life experiences, whose childhood experiences, whose mental health experiences make them vulnerable to running after that high. Baby rats that are licked by their mums and feel loved, if you like, and have that sense of touch, will be more resistant to trauma when they're adults than baby rats that are ignored. And we know that the sort of love and the care and attention that humans get when they're growing up can be very important to how their epigenetics enable them to deal with stress and cortisone production. So if you've got a loved child, that child will be resilient, and even bad things won't have such a terrible effect on it as kids who are not raised with love or support, kids who were abused sexually or psychologically, whose needs for love were ignored, and they become kids who are very, very, very vulnerable to stressors and to, it's called adverse childhood experiences. And the more you have, the more likely you are to have problems in adolescence or in adulthood.
Whatever path in life leads someone into a cycle of addiction, getting out can be tricky, especially for folks without financial wherewithal or built-in family support.
If you're upper class or wealthy or a professional, you tend to have more social capital going for you. You have a better chance probably of getting through relapses and getting straight again.
Why don't you just stop? That's what I get. Why don't you just stop? Well, it's not that simple, okay? Have you ever tried this before? Because if not, then you have no idea.
Back in Mission along Logan Avenue, Aaron describes opioid withdrawal.
You hit that 24-hour mark and it's just like your whole body, how you feel, and just, yeah, it's different for everybody, but me, it's like I'm having a panic attack. It feels like I'm like a butterfly trying to come out of a cocoon. I'm like, my skin is just crawling, and I just like, it's just, oh, like, if anybody ever's been to a native sweat before and they like throw that one bit of hot water on those rocks, and it just hits you, all that steam, and it feels like all your skin's peeling off of you. Yeah, that feeling, it's horrible, and it's like that, it's that hot, like, it's just, it's horrible feeling.
And only one thing will end it.
Yeah, and that's more.
It takes a while to come down from that because it changes the chemistry of the brain. And it takes a while to put the chemistry and the neurophysiology of the brain back together.
One first-line therapy option to help wean people off of opioids is the methadone program.
It's been doing me good.
Is that working for you?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's Owen in Mission.
Since I've been on methadone, I don't steal for my fix, because you don't really need it, right? So take it or leave it.
Every year, up until recently, about 24,000 British Columbians start methadone. You don't get a buzz off it. All it does is stop you going into withdrawal symptoms. The longer you're on this program, the more likely you are to manage to get away from the drugs and achieve stability and recovery. Our six-month retention is about 50%. And last time I looked, 12-month retention in that program was around 30%.
Dr. Kendall says in spite of methadone offering that narrow shot at recovery, some people continue to discount it as an invalid form of treatment.
This is an attitude that people are imbued with, that addictions are wrong, addictions are a moral failure, and that if you're taking methadone or buprenorphine, you're still dependent on a drug and you haven't made a full recovery.
Opioid addiction is a notoriously difficult fight, and Dr. Kendall says the risk of a relapse must be addressed as part of any recovery strategy.
And to deny people access to a drug that could help them not relapse is bad therapeutics in my mind. One notable thing about opioid dependency is that relapse is very common. If you have gone abstinence-based through either a treatment system that's weaned you off drugs, or you've been put in jail and you've been weaned off drugs, should you relapse and go back to the street, you will have lost your tolerance. And the dosage that would make you high previously will kill you this time round. Now, if you don't relapse, relapse to drug use, you're fine. That's great. But the rate of relapse is very high, and it's seen by many in the treatment system as a failure and a stigma. And so rather than trying to relapse-proof people by telling them this is an issue, that if they're starting to feel the need to use again, they can come back to you and get, maybe increase your dose of methadone or take something else. They feel ashamed about it. It's a failure. They don't want to admit to it. They do it in the quiet in the room with street drugs, and they die.
Especially the young men that are using.
That's Ernestine.
In almost all those cases of the young people that I knew personally, they used alone because they were embarrassed. They didn't want people to know that they were using. And they died, you know, in their car, in their trailer. And they were basically healthy young males, but because of the toxic, poisonous drugs, they died, and the families were shocked. So they didn't want to tell anybody what happened. I just think it's so important that we spread the word, stop the stigma, no more shame, no more blame. It's okay to talk about. It's important to talk about.
Those lost to the toxic drug crisis will not soon be forgotten. In Mission, Jeremy Liebrecht says he knew Zach since they were kids.
He was a really good part of this community. He tried to help as much as he could as well.
Zach was really kind-spirited.
That's Rose.
He always tried to make any situation funny.
He would light up the room whenever he walked in, you know.
Found out he passed away. Overdose.
He was actually, he got clean before the last couple months before he passed away, and that's what I mean. These drugs are so strong now, you take a break even, and you want to relapse, just you got to be careful, because that's what happened to Zach, and we all never thought that that would ever happen to him, right?
Owen says that he's missing a lot of people.
I don't have a single person left. Everyone I've ever loved is dead from opiates. It's countless, actually, the people that you know that would die from fentanyl overdose.
The toxic drug death crisis disproportionately affects Indigenous peoples. For example, BC's First Nations Health Authority reported in 2023 that Indigenous people are greater than 6 times more likely to die of an overdose than other BC residents.
Part of the drug addiction problems stems from years of colonization, residential schools, and the survivors, and they're still coping, trying to survive.
There's generations of intergenerational trauma.
And when children grow up, when in their own homes, their parents can't even parent them because they're struggling to survive through the trauma of what happened to their parents. And it's like a vicious cycle. So from an Indigenous focus point, we try to encourage that culture and land is medicine, good medicine, and it's healing.
They got to be loved. Somebody's got to love them.
People need to be properly trained with how to use naloxone.
We're all in it together, right?
There's always help, right? Like, talk to people.
Unless you've gone through it firsthand or vicariously, it's a layer of trauma that you don't want to project onto people just for their own education.
Mom and dad, talk to your kids.
We need to stop the shame, be non-judgmental, and love unconditionally. Let's make change so that we save some lives.
For Viewpoints and for the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Mike McCullough.
Thanks so much to Mike McCullough and his many guests for filling in for us this week. Mike will also be with us again next week with another story, this time about musician Shamir Virgo. Do not miss this beautiful documentary. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative. For comments, story ideas, or just to tell us more about yourself, please write to us, radio@frequencynews.ca. Our website is frequencynews.ca. That's it for us this week, and until the next, ciao. This episode of Viewpoints is a rerun. Happy holidays.
Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca.
CFRC's funding drive is now underway and running through December 31st. Donate today and get amazing CFRC prizes. For every $5 you donate, you also earn a ticket for one of our weekly raffle draws featuring prizes from local businesses including Old Farm Fine Foods, The Screening Room, Smokes Poutinerie, Studio 330, Tango Nuevo, Terra Natural Foods, The Toucan, The Wit, and YGK Thrift. Enjoy the benefits of donating. Give today via CFRC.ca.
You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Cataraqui on Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee land.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of Plugged in My Ears. This week, Kyle, Adam, and I are here, but we're joined by a special guest. Our good friend James is here. James is in physiotherapy at Queen's, but he's quite an athlete himself. James, maybe do you want to just give them a bit of rundown on your athletic trajectory and career real quick so that they understand that you're an esteemed individual, just like the three of us former athletes who are now in retirement?
Thank you very much for the kind words, Sam. I'm in physiotherapy here, and growing up, I played some hockey, lacrosse, and rugby. And then after that, after sustaining some different injuries, mainly concussions, I got into powerlifting. And yeah, stuck with that for a little while and got national records in the squat, bench, and deadlift, 755 squat, 496 bench, and 805 deadlift. So, you know, was eating a lot of food and lifting a lot of weights, and it was a great time. So just hyped to be on the show here tonight, talk some hockey with the boys, and yeah, thanks for having me on.
All right, James, buddy, we're bloody happy to have you here. It's not every day that we get to hang out with a national champion or powerlifter, record make breaker sort of thing. But let's get right into it. We got a lot to talk about. The NHL is going crazy. Kyle Adam, I see you jittering over there. You got lots to say. What are you starting off with?
Well, today? I'll start with one thing. I think our old guest, Zach, another powerlifter, has got some competition. I'm not sure he's winning this one, but Zach was another powerlifter we had on. But we'll go into hockey. So I spoke about the Senators. We usually speak about the Senators. I said at the start of the season, I was skeptical on their performance, and looks like things are panning out just how I predicted. The hardened crown is struck again. It's keeping these guys in the bin. I think Stützle's been celebrating a little bit, maybe too much, but looks like he's found his footing a tiny bit more than last season. I don't know about the others, but...
I can say after last game, I just watched Vancouver play Ottawa. It looks like they forgot to clean Tom Brady's bum and his diaper was still full because he had a bit of a temper tantrum out there on the ice. Yeah. Never seen such a belligerent player before, but... You know, he threw the body quite a bit, got some penalties as per usual when the team was down. He got himself ejected, which was great because with him not being there, the team got a lot better. Tim Stützle also fought, though, so.
Who's this, Kachuk?
Yeah, Kachuk got kicked out. Brady Kachuk did, yeah. His diaper was dirty.
Was this against Vancouver?
Yeah, they lost.
I thought Quinn Hughes got kicked out, too, though.
Quinn Hughes got kicked out.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah, double ejection. But Quinn Hughes got kicked out after having maybe three or four shifts in the first period. Honestly, I think it was really just for the optics. The hit wasn't that bad. You know when you pin someone on the board, sometimes they fall? The guy fell and smashed his face against the board. It's like, it was a hit from behind, but that would have been a two-minute penalty if the guy didn't get in.
Knowing Quinn Hughes, I don't think it was intentional.
But. No, actually, honestly, I just think he tried to pin the guy and pinned him too hard.
Yeah, he only had six penalty minutes on the season before that. So, I mean, I don't think he's...
Yeah, he's pretty clean player.
I don't even think he got his...
He's also pretty small, so I don't know. about 170 pounds.
He's not a big player. Yeah, I think when you're going into like the boards with that much speed, sometimes it's not intentional to hit someone behind. That being said, with Brady Tkachuk, absolute peripheral monster for the fantasy there. I'm sad I didn't draft him, but he definitely had a temper tantrum that game. Who was it that he fought again?
I don't even know. I think it was some call-up from the
fourth liner.
Yeah.
It was an unnecessary fight.
It was an unnecessary fight. He did absolutely torch him, but the size difference was huge. So I don't think that's too big of a feather in Brady's cap there.
No, but Tim Stutz also dropped the gloves. That was hilarious. He threw five punch and all five of them hit Casper the Ghost. Watching in the background, not a single one hit whoever he was fighting. It was a pretty interesting spectacle. But even when he got the 5-minute penalty too, when both of them were gone, the Sens started playing better. So maybe it's time to change up the leadership and send those guys back to the bar and bring up some guys from Belleville.
Yeah.
But
no, I'll say one more thing. I mean, I last year I remember saying on the Ottawa like Reddit group chat, like Ottawa Senators Reddit group chat, I made a comment saying like the goaltending is not an issue. It's fully our defense and team structure. Uh-huh. And I got chewed out so bad. So mm-hmm. many people were so mad at me. And I was just like, well, Ottawa has cycled through the most goalies in the entire league. It's not even close. We had Cam Talbot at one point. Mm-hmm. We thought he was terrible. Got rid of him. Oh, look, he was pretty good in LA, and he's actually still pretty good on Detroit right now. So yeah, I don't know if he was that terrible. I mean, okay, I will agree. Some of our goaltending last year might have been a bit dicey, but Allmark's not looking that hot right now. I think he's below 900. So if you told someone that last season, they would probably be pretty surprised.
I think the majority starting goalies are below 900 this year, though.
I think that's
universal across the league right now.
I read something that the 900 save percentage is becoming a thing of the past because of how high scoring the league has become. How little shots that they're taking to score as many goals as they are.
I would say there's at least about 10 that have above 900 that I can name off right now. But
I guess I would expect Allmark to be top 10 in save percentage.
But no, and my point is, especially he's a good goaltender. There's no way, you know.
Wins with a .938. I believe that was 22-23 for the Boston Bruins, which is insane. He was originally not the starting goalie that year, Swayman was, and then he just kept winning games with ridiculous save percentages. So we know he's got a lot in him. So I think maybe switching cities is affecting him a little bit, but also that Ottawa defense kind of finding their stride is going to be instrumental. Yeah.
Speaking about Swayman, it seems like he got hit by the magic stick of not something good, but he's having even worse of a season than Allmark right now. Yeah. I don't know. The Boston Bruins got hit by something not good.
They're leaning on Corpusalo now.
Right from Ottawa. Yeah.
Coming from Ottawa. Swayman was being basically bartering for that big contract, and then he got it, and he's absolutely been just not doing what he needs to do. So hopefully he can figure it out.
Yeah, I saw a clip from a couple games ago. The Bruins got booed off the ice after a pretty brutal. Yeah, at home at a home game. I mean, we're pretty familiar with that one in Ottawa, but it's a new one for the Bruins based on their last couple seasons.
Sounds like that might start happening in Montreal too.
No, I don't think so.
No, I don't think that's happening in Montreal.
They won't boo until they miss the playoffs again this year, and then next year, maybe. The boos will start.
I think just two more years of booing, and then two more years of losing before the booing?
I don't know. Next year, when Demidov comes over, he's going to tear up the league, win Rookie of the Year. Montreal's going to the playoffs. It's going to be a good time in Montreal.
Heard it here first.
Yeah, you heard it here first. I've been saying this since maybe
speaking of Canadian teams, Connor Hellebuyck leading the Winnipeg Jets to the fastest team in NHL history to get 14 wins. What do we think is so special about the Jets to do that this year early? And do you guys think they're going to continue that?
Well, I think there's a lot to it. But one of the best things that they have is their dynamic and that they obviously have a first line. They have some guys that are better than others. But if you take their first line compared to the average first line in the NHL, I wouldn't really consider any of their guys super high-end guys. But take their fourth line and compare that to the average third line, mm-hmm. pretty consistent. Their third line's pretty consistent with the lower-level second lines, and their second lines could be like a pretty bad/mediocre first line. I think they're just pretty well-structured and well-rounded. And I think the fact that they have incredibly solid goaltending and reinforces those players' ability to play above and beyond what they should actually be playing.
Mm.
And I think a lot of it really stems from back there. From experience, at least, when you have a goaltender who's that hot and that good, it gives you the confidence to be willing to make mistakes. And when you're willing to make mistakes, you tend to make a lot of good plays because you don't hesitate. And when you don't hesitate, you can do a lot with the puck.
I think Connor Hellebuyck's like one of the only goaltenders in the league, even compared to Shesterkin, that's just so consistent. Like, he just never seems to have a bad game. I mean, I've seen him falter maybe once or twice, but it usually isn't even him. It's usually the team had a bad game. But yeah, he's definitely a goaltender you want to have, and I'd hope they don't let him go. I mean, they had a pretty solid season last year, so I'm actually not that surprised. Like, their regular season was very solid last year.
Hellebuyck did seem to not look quite like his usual self in the playoffs last year. After that Vezina performance, I don't know if that was an injury or what was going on there. I agree with everything you guys have said, and then obviously, Morrissey's a great D-man. Pionk and DeMello have been playing really well on their blue line as well as the other D-core. So it looks like they're all kind of just all coming together. But back to the confidence thing, when I was watching them on that streak, they just looked unbelievably confident. All their lines were skating really well. And they were just playing with a ton of momentum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Kyle Connor is probably an underrated player. I don't know if I'd put him in the basement category there, but he's...
I'm not saying he's in the basement category. I'm just saying, like, if you're the team looking to pick up two guys and Mitch Marner and Kyle Connor there, you're probably going to take Mitch Marner.
Oh, yeah, probably. I mean...
I'd take Kyle Connor.
Yeah, he's... Yeah.
I would as well.
Kyle Connor's pretty solid. He's got... He puts a lot of goals up. Like a lot of goals.
Why do you not like Mitch Marner? Please explain it, Adam. Elaborate.
I think he's
listening, by the way.
He doesn't play up to his what he's worth, what he thinks he's worth. I don't know. I really hate when players like want a contract really bad. I know that sounds really bad because like obviously they need contracts, but I don't know. I think Marner thinks he's up there with Matthews and Nylander, and I think Matthews and Nylander are on a different tier than Marner. And I don't know. I think that maybe you should have the confidence and the ego of what your game is like. I don't know what your game actually looks like. I just get a weird vibe from the guy, honestly. I don't know.
Think he's very mature.
Yeah, I do think he has a little sense of immaturity to him. I'm not trying to bash his play, but I mean, he's just not that guy. I don't know. I think I would want more of a character leader like Kyle Connor. I mean, you saw Kyle Connor going out there trying to drop the gloves with Crosby. I love that. I mean, anytime you can take out Captain Canada, right?
Captain Canada.
But yeah, no, Kyle Connor is a bruiser. I mean, I don't think Marner's ever gone on a 16-game win streak, anything close to that.
And does the player go on that win streak or does the team?
I really think Kyle Connor had a major impact on the team going that way. And I don't think Marner can contribute to that. I don't think you can win 16 games with Mitch Marner on your team in a row.
So you think because Mitch Marner's on a team, possible.
I think he's more of a locker room cancer. Yeah, I really do.
So you describe him as like a Montreal Canadiens legend, PK.
No, fan? I'm not. And you know what?
Just to be clear, you think that he's a bit of a princess,
Marner, 100%.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Have you seen that Prime show?
Yeah, when Nylander's ripping into him, saying like, "Stop crying."
Yeah, I don't know if that was the best look on Marner. I mean, it kind of confirmed what I already knew about that team, but yeah, he didn't look the greatest in that. One thing I'll say, one more final thing about the Jets there. The only concern I have is I think special teams.
Is their special teams bad? I thought they were doing fine.
I don't think they're bad. I just don't think they're high enough tier to win playoffs.
Okay. Yeah, just with how important special teams are.
That's just how it is. If you don't have a good, like, you have to have such a good power play to win the playoffs. Like, that's what carried the Oilers through. It is. Like, they had such a good power play, and they also had a ridiculously good PK.
Oilers have one of the best PKs in the league for sure.
Oh yeah, that's the recipe to win. So you need to have those like locked down. I mean,
You can be confident. Dry in his spot on the right side there. You know he's gonna start snizzing when the puck goes, and McDavid's gonna have some crazy feet.
Because 5-on-5 is so locked down in the playoffs. So that's the problem the Jets faced. I think that's what I think happened to them. And I watched their run last year. Mm. I would kind of diagnose it as that they just had a scoring problem, mostly because they're a 5-on-5 team that just couldn't produce in the.
Well, a quick point to finish the conversation with Marner. I mean, the playoffs is just a totally different game. You have almost double the hits a game. He's not a big guy. He's not a super physical player. He scores a lot of his goals off the fast break, and you lose a lot of that in playoffs. You are getting hit a lot more, and I think he shies away from that. I mean, he had 3 points in 7 games, didn't do anything for Toronto in that series. Nylander came back after that concussion and absolutely carried. So, I mean, a guy like Kyle Connor, I'm more confident he's going to score. I mean, he had 3 goals in 5 games over that 5-game span for Winnipeg. So I think Mitch Marner is a great player, but he needs to be more physical if he wants to be able to be like a positive force in the playoffs next year.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. Marner's a great player. He's just not as good as he thinks he is.
I mean, I'll hold this statement. I think as soon as he transfers out of Toronto, he'll get much better.
Where Marner should go? Washington.
Why Washington?
That would be interesting.
But why? He can set up Ovechkin to beat the goals record. Washington's buzzing right now.
They're buzzing.
You add Marner to that team where he plays like a third string role behind Strome and Ovechkin. I'd rather play under Strome and Ovechkin than Matthews and Nylander. Matthews and Nylander are great, but I definitely think Marner's playing like third string there. I don't think he likes it. I would rather play third string for a veteran like Ovechkin. Has been around, won a cup, knows what it takes to win. And I think that'd be a perfect spot for Marner to go. I mean, do you think Toronto's gonna like?
I don't think
long-term plans.
No,
it's not happening. I think he's out of the picture in a few years.
So what do you boys? So seeing Washington do so good, I would put them in top six, top seven powerful team in the NHL right now with all the wins they've been getting. They lost a couple after Ovi got out, but what do you think's been the recipe of their success this year?
I mean, they had a couple pickups. One of them, I'm not gonna say Chychrun is a huge contributor, but they did get Chychrun from Ottawa for essentially a bag of pucks. Quite literally. I can't even tell you, but we didn't get him. We got nothing from him. So that was a pretty decent pickup for them. Their goaltending has actually been solid. That's what was able to sustain them last year. Their goaltending won them a bunch of games. So that's part of it. I don't know. I mean, Ovi, when you have a player like Ovi being that hot, one of the top goal scorers in the league, that's definitely contributing to some of that. He had a hat trick the other game, and
he's got 15. I think he was leading before he got injured, before he broke his leg. Connor McMichael, really been impressed with him. I think he has 12 goals now. And watching his games, he's so fast. He's super dynamic. He finds himself in a lot of really high chance scoring opportunities on fast breaks. Almost cherry picking, but he's getting those feeds. And honestly, I think he's the real deal. I think he could put up over 30 this year, and I think we might see like a 40, maybe even more in the rest, like throughout his career, goal scorer. So, to the goaltending, Logan Thompson's been really good.
Yeah.
Coming from Vegas, he's a solid goalie.
Logan Thompson's
been playing,
good, yeah.
He's been playing great for them. And Lindgren's not shabby either.
No, yeah.
I'm surprised they're splitting 50-50. I did not see that.
Lindgren's good. He was good last year.
Yeah, but I don't know. I thought Logan Thompson was good last year. Logan Thompson.
I mean, I think they just don't want to over, like, if they've got two goaltenders that are relatively equal standing, you don't really want to overwork one of them. So
I know. I think that's a pretty good challenge. Pretty good problem to have. Like, I think it's great when you have two goalies who are both hot, both playing well, who have to fight to be number one. Mm-hmm. I can't think of a better problem to have. Like, that's like saying, yeah, the most like quasi like existentially important player on your team has someone who's equally as important. So if one goes down, you can very confidently replace him with the other.
Oh, I see why Washington's so good.
Why?
They have Pierre-Luc Dubois.
Well, that's actually, he's pretty good.
Well, you know what? If they can make him work, then he can be really good.
But, they had some good pickups.
As evidenced by Torts, he can be pretty lazy, and he's happy to get yelled at on the bench. By
Oh, yeah, in Columbus. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, that was some time ago.
Who is the rookie that's on Philadelphia that Torts healthy scratched? Mitchkov, and then just came back and just had, like, great, he's been... Producing
like one of the best players on Philadelphia.
I know.
Torts has got to be one of the smartest mental coaches of all time. I'm telling you, he did that just to light a fire.
He did, for sure.
It worked.
It worked because he came out angry.
Yeah. What do you guys think about Torts in general? Like a lot of NHL guys think he's a bit of a schmuck. John Scott's biography about himself has a chapter dedicated to how much he hates Torts.
John Scott was a bit of a schmuck too, though.
So yeah, I don't know.
No, he's a nice guy. Most people liked him. Patty Kane loves him.
All the
Chicago guys love John Scott.
Okay, but you play against John Scott.
I don't know what the other teams.
Like John Scott. You see the video of him backing?
Yeah. And then just see what happened to Phil Kessel? Not even a penalty.
I mean, I'd be scared. I'd swing my stick at John Scott.
John Scott didn't do anything to him.
Coming at me.
Didn't do anything to him. Even hit him.
I think Torts is just do anything to win kind of coach, and no one you know, when you're on the losing end of that, I don't think you like it. No, I mean, that's not really surprising, but Philadelphia should not be as good as it is. The same thing happened last season. Like, they were way better than they're supposed to be.
No, you attribute that to Torts.
I just attribute that to him not playing with emotions. Like, if you're someone's playing bad, he just bench them.
Yeah. Speaking of Mitchkov and the Senators, he scored that OT winner a couple weeks back. It was a sharp angle shot. I'm sure Ullmark wanted that one back. That was pretty pretty basic for the goaltender to just hug the post, but he was kind of just mohawking right around the hash marks, got a feed, and just that really quick release just caught Ullmark off guard. So I think Mitchkov's insane. I think he's going to turn into one of the superstars in the NHL, and he's already kind of showing that. And I agree with you, Sam. I think Tortorella's master mental coach kind of healthy scratching him, putting that fire under him, and he came back. Just looks absolutely unreal. So I'm excited to see what he does for the rest of the season and for the seasons to come.
Oh, likewise. But also, just on a separate talk of rookies, this has been a big debate recently. A lot of people think Celebrini is going to be better than Bedard because Bedard's a bit slower than Celebrini, and Celebrini's bigger, faster, and stronger. I mean, do you guys really think that Celebrini is actually going to be better than Bedard?
I don't know better. I think they're just different players. I initially said I compared Bedard more to like a Matthews kind of style. Like, Matthews is not known for his like edge work or like smooth skating. I would say he's more just, he's got a really good shot.
I don't know about that. Matthews is known to be slow, but to have incredible edge work. That was like in his NHL League prospects perspective. He was described as one of the most talented and able skaters in NHL history.
I mean, I'll put it this way. Like, if you ask, like, a bunch of NHL players who's skating would you want, I don't think they're going to name Matthews.
No, they're not. They won't name Speed, but I don't think it's...
My point is that Matthews is such a good player because of his goal scoring and shots. Mm. I'd attribute Bedard to kind of the same thing. Bedard's got a wicked snapshot and that kind of toe drag release. So I think he's more in that category. So Celebrini's kind of fast. Mm-hmm. And he's a pretty good passer, like more of a playmaker. Bedard's a great playmaker too. I don't know. I don't know if I'd really compare them that way. Like, I think Bedard's got a bit more. He's a bit shorter though. No.
Yeah, Bedard is. I think I want to say he's 5'10". He's 5'10". Yeah, and Celebrini's I think 6'1".
Yeah. So he's got a bit of size.
Bedard's a bit of a smaller guy. Obviously, Matthews is pretty huge. He's like 6'3". I mean, I think Bedard's on a different level than Celebrini. I think Celebrini could come into his own. I think Bedard's stick handling is just unreal, and he has that really explosive speed where he can kind of burst into open spaces. And like Kyle was saying, he's got a really, really nice that kind of toe drag release that Matthews has kind of coined, kind of changes the angle on the goalie and it comes off the stick really quickly, which can be really dangerous for goal scoring. I think it'll be interesting to see how he develops. Obviously, like, being 5'10", it's not small. It's also not huge though, so we'll see how he is able to kind of like play to his game there. But yeah,
well, average in the NHL is also 6'2" now.
Yeah,
so it is a little bit small.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. What do you think, Adam?
I think it's way too early to compare them.
It's kind of like the OV Crosby debate when they started.
Yeah, I don't Celebrating know. His 23 games into his career. I mean, I don't know.
Actually, you know what? That's really not like the OV Crosby thing because those guys started the same year because of the NHL lockout.
Also, I think Bedard's having a bit of a rough season. And I think if Bedard was setting the world on, you know, if Bedard was playing at the same pace he was playing last year, this conversation wouldn't even be happening. Because I think the only reason he's getting sucked down to Celebrini's level is because of his poor play to start the year. And I also think Celebrini has a better team around him to develop Bedard has in Chicago. I mean, they got Foligno and Taylor Hall, but Taylor Hall's been a healthy scratch for the last two games or something like that now.
Yeah.
Like, San Jose's got Toffoli. They've got a lot of younger talent around him. And, I mean, I like San Jose's situation.
Granlund and Zetterlund have been really good, too. I think Granlund has, like, he's over 20 points now. He's actually been playing really nicely on the top line. Chicago does have Bertuzzi, and they did pick up Teravainen, but they're not doing a whole lot.
Yeah.
So I agree with you. I think he's got better pieces around him. I also think Bedard's going to pick it up big time.
I think so, too. Yeah. No.
What do you think about this season, you mean?
He's looked good.
I think this season. Because he was averaging almost a point a game last season. He's under that this season.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's going to pick it up. I just think it's a little bit of a slow start for the guy. Yep. But yeah.
I think people also, I said this at the start of the season, I think people had some expectations that might have been a little bit unrealistic. Like, people were saying 100 points or something. I was like, okay, well.
I still think it's realistic for him.
It's not impossible. I'm just saying that's you're pushing the bill a little bit with how bad his team is, too. Like, it's not like he's getting some freebies from anyone on his team. He's kind of working for every single point, right? I mean, if he got 80 points again, that'd be crazy. Like, that's really good. So, I mean, I'm not actually worried about him at all.
Yeah. You know what I'm not worried about? Nashville. I think Nashville's going to win the cup.
Whoa, okay.
Yeah. I think Nashville's
because they've been off to a real slow start. We were talking about that before they got in here. They got Shea, they got Marchessault, they got Stammers, but they had an absolutely terrible start. And Soros wasn't looking great either. He just got re-signed, and we know he's a top goalie in the NHL. So, why are you saying that? What do you think is going to come together for them?
Now, I know you just mentioned Soros, and I think Soros is actually having a good season. He's save percentage is above 900. His goals against average is below 2.5. He's got two shutouts. Those are pretty good numbers from a guy that's on a losing hockey team. That has 7 wins, he's got 6 of them.
And they're minus 15, I think. Yeah,
I don't really think you can put all the blame on him. I think they just haven't meshed yet. I think that the chemistry's not there, and I think they might need to make a coaching change.
Yeah, that's possible.
I think that might be the way to go. Because, I mean, we saw, was it St. Louis and Boston a couple years ago in the Stanley Cup Finals? And St. Louis was, like, really low in the standings at, like, the halfway point, and then they actually made a coaching change, and they went on and won the cup. I see a similar thing happening with Nashville. Maybe the cup is a little too much, but I think they're making the playoffs. I think they will be a top three team in the Central.
You know,
I think it's going to be Winnipeg, Nashville, and Dallas in the Central. But
I'm not actually opposed to you making that claim. I forget the year. I believe it was St. Louis. They were dead last in the NHL
at
Christmas.
Yeah, that year, yep.
And they came back and won the Stanley Cup. And one advantage Nashville has is that they have a decent few Canadian players. Turns out that, if, you know, upwards of 50% of your team is Canadian, you tend to win the Stanley Cup. Mm-hmm. It seems to be how it works right now.
Interesting.
Yeah. The least amount of players an NHL team has had when they won the Stanley Cup since the 05 lockout has been 81% of their team is Canadian.
Well, yeah. I think the only piece that they got missing there is the other stat that you need to win is usually have prospects that pan out and some younger players. I don't know if they really have that. They sent that. They had that nice prospect of a goalie, but they kind of turfed him, sent him down. I think he's just developing in the A right now. But
I think that was also to assert that they were confident in Saros.
Yeah, I know. And it feels bad. Actually, no, the goalie, sorry, that goalie got traded.
Yeah, he's on San Jose now. Yeah. Askarov. Yeah. I don't know. I think Pittsburgh won, and they didn't have really any prospects throughout the past.
That's in the past. I think that it's. Years. I'm saying it's changed. Mm-hmm. The dynamics changed.
When
I
won in 2016, 2017.
Even 2009.
Wasn't Gonzalo a prospect in 2016?
I would say he was one of the better players on Pittsburgh in 2016. I don't know if he was a prospect at the time.
I'm saying more of like you need to have the only like with the current cap space, the only way to win is your fourth line's gonna have to be people that are getting paid like minimal, right?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the only way to have someone that's really good and paid super low is for them to be like new or a rookie kind of.
That's a good point.
So that's good point. I'm saying with the cap space, you can't win essentially because you're gonna have a weak fourth and third line if you don't have enough prospects or new players that you've drafted in for cheap.
It's hard to win without taking advantage of the IR spot or team friendly contracts. Mm-hmm. Like Hyman was on for 5, I think Nuge was on for a little over 5, Evander was on for 5 on Edmonton, and speaking to the coaching change in Nashville, I think that's a really great point, because Edmonton at the start of last season started off 2-9. Everyone was extremely disappointed in how they started. They brought in Chris Knobloch. They ended up going 18 in a row, tied the NHL record for most wins, almost beat it. And Knobloch was just an amazing coach even throughout the playoffs. He made a bunch of switches that people would question. After they were down 3-0 to Florida, they won 2 games in a row, and then they switched Fogle onto Dreisaitl's line, completely switched up the dynamics of the line after winning 2. Everyone questioned it. It worked out really well. Fogle ended up scoring early that game, and then they tied and brought it to 7. So I think the coaching change is a good idea, and it can just totally shift the dynamic if it's the right person.
Yeah. Speaking of coaching, I saw there's a really interesting coaching call from the Seattle Kraken. I don't think I've ever seen this before. Before the game started, Kraken's coach decided to she checked the starting lineups for the other team. I can't remember which teams were playing, but she noticed that they had started guys that weren't on the list, and if you do that, apparently that's a penalty.
Mm-hmm.
So
incorrect scorecard. Yeah,
so she got the Kraken a 2-minute penalty at the start of the game by noticing that they put the wrong guys out, essentially, or they had one player that was the wrong player playing, and 2-minute penalty start of the game. So that's probably good. That's pretty good coaching, in my opinion.
It seems like she's doing a pretty good job. The players seem to like her a lot on that team, and I think the organization is pretty happy with the structural changes.
Yeah, I mean that is an example where that was fully her. She just was had her eye on the ball and just like, we're gonna have free power play here. So yeah, that's a good move.
No, what a better way to start a hockey game too with a power play, right?
Yeah, no kidding. But school sports, Vanier Cup this past weekend in Kingston. Pretty interesting score, but more interesting still was just the fans. I mean, I thought that was hilarious. Sorry, it's kind of unrelated to the actual game itself, but we somehow crashed a Laurier alumni event, and they had some interesting things to say about people who cheer for Laval and return people from Laval.
Quebec's been good. They've been good at football last couple of seasons. Laval has been strong.
UDM, Montreal. But Adam, do you have the score there by any chance?
Yeah, 22-17. Laval beat Laurier.
Tight.
I can't say. I honestly forgot the game was happening.
The only reason why I remembered it was happening is because a guy walked up to me and told me it was happening, and that's when I realized we crashed the Laurier alumni.
I see.
Too bad. Queens was poising themselves to make these two Vanier Cups, and we kind of got rough seasons in these two last years.
One of the heads of this radio station that we're on saying that Queens would be in the Vanier Cup both of this year. And
Queens was actually planning to go for a full run last year, and it didn't pan out. Just before we head out, I got one last question. I'm not a huge NFL follower, but I have a question for Adam. I heard that Shaquan had a crazy game.
Yeah, he went nuts. 255 yards, 2 touchdowns. It's like the 7th best running game in NFL history. He's on my fantasy team.
Oh yeah,
you're life is good, man. I was actually down 30 points and he scored 49 for me to win. So I will take that any day of the week.
Oh, yeah, and you won the week.
Oh yeah. Saquon Barkley. No, Saquon Barkley has been great this season. The Eagles have been a great change of scenery. I mean, the Giants have just fallen apart since he's left. I mean, they just released Danny Dimes. It's a very sad day in New York, but looks bright for the Eagles. And I mean, the Bills beat